Let me say what I didn't say yesterday or the day before, as far as that goes, and that is that much of what I'm presenting this week may be found in this little book called A Worship Workbench. I prepared it over a series of some months for a kind of a serial inclusion in a thing called Circle, and you ought to describe the Circle, as a matter of fact. Circle is the journal or the publication of Campus Ministry Communications and of Lutheran Council USA. So you can write to Lutheran Council USA and subscribe to Circle, and you can also write to Lutheran Council USA and get this book. And it's $1.50, I think, in individual copies, but if you buy 10 for a study group or for your worship committee or something like that, I think it's $1. And I don't get any royalty or anything like that.
You're good.
Honest, yeah, I must have. But it's very useful, and I think they've found it useful in junior colleges and other places, kind of giving an overview of worship. Lutheran Council USA, Campus Ministry Communications, 130 North Wells Street, Chicago. Illinois, 60606.
Hugh does in the bookstore, too.
Yes, they've got them in the bookstore here. So, I am willing once again to back up a little bit if you want to. My argument a couple of days ago was that we're living in an age of change and that the church is involved in that change, and we've got, therefore, four areas of homework, all of which overlap: creed, code, cult, and constitution. Our chief concern, or my chief concern these days, is cult, but I hope it's clear by now that they all kind of intertwine and overlap. And I also suggested that religion, that is to say, the way people perceive the heights and depths of their own existence, is not going out of style, and even the way people act out their perceptions of existence and so on, in liturgy, in ritual, that's not going out of style either. And people these days are as fully religious as they used to be. They may not be Christian, but they're religious, and they want to find out, they want to get handles on what is important to them, and they want to be able to act that out. And the Christian faith, I think, allows them to do that and encourages them to do that. And I would want to see the word religion used as a good word, as one of the incarnational, one of the ways in which God comes to us. Yesterday I talked about...
Come on in.
Yesterday I suggested what use the tradition might be to us, and I gave three or four good reasons why it's still good to study the tradition and to have a tradition and hang on to it. And then I suggested that the tradition is made up of these various levels of loyalty, from the biblical to the Catholic to the confessional to the national synodical to the parochial or parish, and even right down to the personal. And I suggested that each of these levels contributes some implications as today to what our worship ought to be. And that's what we were talking about yesterday, and I'm opening the floor again if you would like to go back over any of that territory. Would you like to go back over any of that? Is there anything that's clear? Would you like to pursue any of those implications? Did somebody raise a hand?
I'm just curling. Anyway, we, of course, just came yesterday afternoon, so
you
I'm going back on ground I have to use what I've read.
I see.
Written, but
I see.
If it isn't reasonable, you know, to the rest of them, I'd like to hear some of your great play, Richard Curry.
Well, I just tried to sketch it out in these few minutes. The biblical tradition, I think, is the fact that our tradition is a biblical tradition, I think, is probably the most important thing. And that suggests some invariables for our worship. It suggests the shape and the pattern of our worship. It suggests that if we're not dealing with the God of Israel and the God of Jesus Christ, then we got the wrong script, among other things. I've attended I've heard of people who attended at a student conference what was presumably some kind of a worship experience where people were invited to sit around in a room and watch a block of ice melt. Mm-hmm. Now that was, maybe there was more to the experience than that, but this is what was reported to me. And that was supposed to be a worship experience. It might have been, but it didn't seem to me to have much, much to do with Israel or with Jesus, and that troubles me. In other words, I think we ought to have some kind of a clear understanding of the referent or the reference of our worship, namely the God who is active in history. and in Jesus and in the church. So that's, you know, it's that kind of implication that we get out of the fact that our tradition is biblical. The Jewishness of Christianity I talked about yesterday. Great ecumenical consensus about that and how really liberating that is as regards a lot of our problems that used to hang us up. Catholic tradition, small c, that means that we ought to take account of the pre-Reformation history of the church and tradition of the church and experience of the church, and the post-Reformation consensus, ecumenical consensus. And the Presbyterians, as I said yesterday, have just finished their new worship book, and they are quoting John Calvin and saying that it is appropriate that the communion be celebrated as often as every Lord's Day. From Calvin. And that was Luther's understanding, too, that the communion is meant to be every Sunday experience. Yeah. And so that makes me ask, golly, that's not the way we do it in most of our Lutheran churches. And then I go on and ask, well, maybe we're sectarian then. Maybe we're not really Catholic, small c. Of course, I think the Roman Catholics have to ask themselves, too, are we Catholic enough? And where have we got homework? And I think they got plenty of homework, too. But we got our homework.
I was just thinking back in your comment about the Jewishness, you know, and how we get the Jewishness of our whole religion. And mm-hmm. I love that. But I was wondering why we don't celebrate some more of the special days that the Hebrews do.
Yeah. Terrific. Some
because
people have begun.
So part of a few churches are doing a Passover, sort of a watered down version of mm-hmm. the Passover, you know, meal.
There's a movement to do just that, as a matter of fact, and include them in our calendar, some Jewish holidays in our calendar.
Mm-hmm.
One very simple way is the one you've already mentioned, that is to say, Passover almost always comes about the same time as our Holy Week and Easter and so on. Sometimes it's a week off, or 2 weeks off, but it's almost always about the same time of year, and there's some great congruences there, just incredible. We have we celebrate Passover in our house, and we have a Seder meal around our table and so on, and we do it for our little campus congregation, and oh, it's very meaningful.
Well, why do you do that?
To remind ourselves that we're Jews. Yeah. Well, exactly for that reason. What does Passover mean? I mean, when we say Christ has become our Passover, you know, what does that mean? Well, we got to know what Passover is, I think. And so that's one way. Another way is some people have suggested that we make Ash Wednesday a kind of Yom Kippur, a Day of Atonement. And that's nifty. Maybe we should also think in terms of Yom Kippur in September or October, when it usually comes for the Jews, however, rather than in the spring when Ash Wednesday comes for us. Sukkot, the Feast of Booths, or Tabernacles. Have you ever seen what the Jews do with that? We have a huge Jewish population at Syracuse University. 40% or something like that. Great, huge Jewish population. And for Sukkot, which is the Feast of Tabernacles, or the Feast of Harvest, it comes, you know, near to our Thanksgiving, and they build a booth, a little kind of a structure out under the stars, presumably, and they lace it with vines and figs and all, and they have fruits hanging down, and it's very, it's a lovely image, and we did that for our little kids in our weekday school. They built a little sukkah, a little booth, and we had it in our church then for Thanksgiving. And I think anything we can do to remind us that we are Jews, spiritually,
it's a teaching
Jews.
Aid.
Pardon?
It's a teaching aid.
Terrific teaching aid, yeah.
Like
Bible
shower
talks,
we ought to get more visual and mm-hmm. verbal.
Yeah.
Boy, that's
interesting. You know, I attended a bat mitzvah for a young girl. Mm. I'm doing that now, but the service was so like our own. I was amazed. Mm-hmm. You know, that I realized there was so much that I didn't really know about the Jewish faith. But even, you know, when they're talking about salvation and things
mm-hmm.
like that. But the form was the same. Close to the same.
Some of you people saw me last night working on this Jewish prayer shawl, and I have one at home, and I was making this for Carol Hinderly here. And that's, again, another kind of a way of reminding us of our Jewish heritage. Friday night, we might make more of a Friday night family worship in our homes. The woman of the house is supposed to light the candles at the table. I mean, there's some nice little ceremonies. There's a community called Taizé, which you may know in France, which is a kind of a monastery of a Protestant monastery, you might say. And on Friday nights and Saturdays, they always light a seven-branch candlestick in their worship as a sign of their solidarity with Judaism.
But they usher out the Sabbath as well as mm. created. You know,
is that right?
Yeah, they have like a Saturday night service, and it's just a celebration. It's singing and dancing, and it's a thanking for the time of worship. Mm.
Great new stuff on the Sabbath that came out in Liturgy. Do you know that magazine? That's another good magazine you ought to get. That's a Roman Catholic publication from the Liturgical Conference in Washington, D.C. It's Massachusetts Avenue, but I forget the precise address. I can get it for you if you want it. Oh, I have it right here. I'll hang on. Yes, I do. 1330 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20005. And Liturgy is their monthly magazine, and it is a mind blower. I may have a copy with me upstairs. It's just excellent. Usually on a theme. The theme a couple of months ago was Sabbath, and what it meant to the Jews, and what it meant to Jesus, and what it meant to the early church, and what it could mean to us today. All right, where were we? Anything else?
I was going to say, speaking about our Jewishness, which to Christians so many times is an offense.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose, I was kind of, I've been in that bag myself, simply because they did not receive the Messiah. We just write that all off.
Yeah.
But what helped me was to recognize that Jesus was such an excellent Jew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was the Jew par excellence.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Terrific.
And that's helped me a great deal to not feel, well, that's Jewish, so what, they missed the Messiah.
Carol Hinderly, a couple of times since we've been here, and we haven't even been here a full week yet, but in a couple of times over the past couple of days, he's mentioned about the Jews carrying us in the promises, and then we carry them. Yeah, boy, that's nice. That's nice. Well, let's take a look again at our tradition, this time as we see it in the Red Book. And I've asked that we get some, and I'm grateful to those people who ran over and got them. Thanks very much. You don't have to open it quite yet, because I want to, as they say, lay a little content on you still. What we're dealing with, as I suggested in our first session, is an incarnational type of theology, an incarnational understanding of the Word, where God speaks to us and comes to us always through a fleshly or human form. I suggested a couple of days ago that the witness of the Holy Spirit is Christocentric, that's true, Christ at the center, but it is theo-ultimate, it goes ultimately to God. Christ came to show us the Father, after all. And it is anthropomorphic. It is in the shape of a human being. That's anthropos, that means man, and morphos, that means shape. So the witness of the Spirit is always in the shape of a human being. That is to say, God never just appears in blinding majesty. He always comes to us in a rejectable form, even. Jesus says, blessed is he who does not take offense. Lutheran Church calls itself the Church of the Word, capital W. And when we use that word, Word, in that sense, we usually mean Jesus himself. Jesus is a word about God, a message about God, God revealing himself to us. And so when we hear the word Word, in Lutheran theology anyhow, we are encouraged to think chiefly of Jesus, because that is God's most important word to us, most important message. I would like to think of that word, so to speak, incognito, in three forms. We used to talk about the means of grace in catechism and confirmation, still do. It's a very good idea. And it's the same idea that I would like to explicate this morning for a little bit, in a slightly different way. The incognitos of grace, the incognitos that God takes when he comes to dwell among us. And I would suggest they are three: written, spoken, and enacted. Okay, the Word, primarily the Word Jesus, the man for others, God's representative for us, but also now in written form. I have a little Bible here. I got one of these small service books, you know, the one that Augsburg puts out, or Fortress. I make the little boxes myself. You can throw them in your suitcase more easily than you can an open book. But I got the smallest ones I could, so I could carry with me wherever I go. And this is a copy of the Bible. And a lot of times, other Protestants, not so much Lutherans, but other Protestants, when they think of the Word of God, they think right away of a book. I would want to make sure that it's clear among us that when we think about Word of God, we think primarily of Jesus as God's word. But there's no question that this book is also an incognito for God's word, Jesus. Luther, you know, had a standard by which he judged the words of Scripture, and anything as far as that goes. What drives you to Christ? What do you find driving you to Christ? And so we find that this book, as well as some other books, as I'll come to in a minute, but this book chiefly provides the first written account of the first oral proclamation about the life and ministry and death and resurrection of Jesus. And so that's why this book is so precious to us. And there's some nice things about a book being a written thing. One of them being that you can investigate it, you can go into it deeply, and you can go back to the original languages in Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic and so on, and you can study it, and you can find out what the original context meant and so on. And Vern has been very helpful in these Bible studies on Isaiah and bringing all that out. That's the nifty thing about the word in its written form. However, it has a drawback, and that would be what you could guess, namely what? Well, interpretation, yes, is one of them, but even more basically...
You begin to worship the written word.
Right, but even more basically...
Give it a context.
Right, but even more basically, you've got to read. You've got to be literate.
Oh.
You know what I mean? The word in its written form, in other words, is a literary product, and you've got to, A, have eyes, you know, be sighted, and B, be literate in whatever language the thing is written. So that, right away, you see, rules out a significant percentage of the population, including, I might add, a significant part of the population of our parishes and our churches. And I think it's a big mistake. We're going to get back to this later, but I think most people, a lot of people anyhow, in the old days, most recently in liturgical experimentation and liturgical reform and so on, thought right away we get out the mimeograph machine and start churning off things to get people to read in the pew. And... I don't think that's the way to begin liturgical reform, with a mimeograph machine or with anything written, because there are people who cannot read, who've never been taught to read, who have bad eyes or poor eyesight or aged or for whatever reasons, you know what I mean, the written word is closed to them, or if not closed, at least not quite so accessible. So the written word has this great virtue that it is investigatable. And we can go back and look at those earliest accounts and go into the Hebrew and the Greek and so on. The trouble with it is that it's static. And it just sits there unless you can read. And unless you, in fact, do read it. So that brings us to the second form that the word takes. And this was Luther's favorite form, the spoken word. And Luther maintained that the spoken word is what really grabs you and addresses you. And I think he's got something. In seminary, we had to read a little book called Servant of the Word by Farmer. You might want to take a look at it. Terrific exposition of the dynamic quality of the spoken word. See, a book, that just sits there on the table until I pick it up, and unless I'm able to read it. But the spoken word, you know, that, boy, that really gets you. And Luther thought preaching and the exposition of Scripture and he extended it, you see, to the mutual, this is a great phrase, the mutual conversation and consolation of Christian brothers. That's where the word was. Word, capital W, you see. The word about God's heart that we know in Jesus, that can be present, not just in a formal sermon type thing, but also in the mutual conversation and consolation of Christian brothers and sisters. That's nice. I should make clear, too, that the canon is not closed for Christians either. Even in the written form, we have to admit that there are other writings besides the Bible that bring us the word, capital W. Sermons, books, devotional books, even literature, even the great literature of the ages. I mean, you can find the word, capital W, speaking in those written forms as well. And you can find the spoken word in sermon, but also in conversation. Which brings us to the third form that the word takes, acted out, enacted.
In the written word, would you also include some creedal statements?
Right, theologies, creedal statements, sure, sure. Liturgies even, I suppose.
Music,
yeah, sure. Hymns, Johann Sebastian Bach, that's written, I suppose. That's also acted out, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyhow, for the pedagogical purposes this morning, let's talk about the written word, the spoken word, and now also the acted out word. And I think we are coming to realize more and more how important it is to take part in an action and to participate, and how people really learn by participating and experiencing. And they learn and they experience, it seems to me, at the deepest level of their being. And I would maintain that acting out is the most effective way that the word can reach you. It's not the most specific. I want to make that clear. You always have to have words, it seems to me, to interpret action and to make comment about it and to make sure that it's quite specific. But nevertheless, it has that virtue of really grabbing you. Let me throw this statistic at you, and I'll throw it again at you later in the week. I've heard the statistic criticized. I should make this qualification right away. I've heard the statistic criticized by some people who say it's absolutely unprovable. But it still seems to me to be so close to the truth that I'm going to use it. 55%, this comes out of the human potential movement and people who study these things. 55% of everything you learn about me when you first meet me is nonverbal. 55% of everything you know about me is not in my words, the words that I say, but in my body language, the way I sit, the way I move, the way I act, the expression on my face, whether I'm smiling, whether I'm frowning, the costume, the clothes that I wear. All of that is nonverbal. You've heard about nonverbal communication. Okay, that's it. You know, whether I appear nervous or whether I appear confident or whether I appear that's all nonverbal. And I buy that almost. Maybe it's undemonstrable, but 55%, I'll bet it is. All right, on top of that, 38% is still not strictly verbal, but what they call vocal. That is the tone of my voice, the speed with which I speak, my inflection, my intonations, how loud, how soft. All of that is vocal. And if you want to know a little more specifically what that category of things involves, think of training a puppy. You know, bad, bad doggy. You shouldn't do your business on the rug. And the dog gets the message, and he puts his tail between his legs and slinks off under a chair. I mean, that's all vocal. The dog doesn't understand the English language. But your body language and your tone of voice and the fact that you're shouting at him and so on, he gets the message. Same with little kids.
Like this morning at that Bible study, his voice, if you couldn't understand a word you're saying,
it's like a symphony.
So
yeah,
good.
Yeah, great.
The appreciation, the reverence, the excitement. You know,
yeah,
it's
right.
Incredible.
Yeah, he uses his voice very nicely.
Yeah.
Well, all that spoke of, what have we got? 55%, then 38%, then another, what's the rest? 7% is verbal. In other words, 7% of my total message to you, so to speak, is the actual cognitive content of my words. Now that ought to give a preacher nightmares. Or a teacher, or a parent. And what does it suggest about our worship? Particularly Lutherans, you see, who are on such a head trip all the time. Lutherans are always talking theology and laying long, heavy exposition and so on. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's okay. But we ought to limit it. We ought to realize its limits. And we ought to recognize also how much we are preaching, quote unquote, in everything else about that experience on Sunday morning. Namely, the architecture, the music, the vestments, the candles, the stained glass, the attitudes of the worshipers, the greeters at the door, whether they're smiling at you, whether they're frowning. I mean, how people learn and how people appropriate the gospel includes all of this acted out stuff, as well as the actual words that we use. And this is no secret to those of us in the Lutheran Society for Worship, Music, and the Arts, right? And it's no secret to the Hebrews, and it's no secret to the Roman Catholic tradition out of the Middle Ages and since and so on. I mean, we knew this stuff all along, but we're only now beginning to recover it and to realize how important it is. And may I say, the Protestants who threw all that stuff out are now coming back to it.
Right.
Because they realize how much of it is pedagogical, how much of it teaches and preaches and communicates. And we still are not teaching this in our seminaries. Uh, we, we, our seminaries are still pretty much a head operation. That is my perception. And we think we've trained pastors when we've taught them wise theology. And we haven't. We've done part of the training, but we haven't done it all. So, concern, this is one of the arguments in my little book and the arguments of my week here among you. Part of our hermeneutic homework, in other words, part of our homework in learning how to be missionaries is simply a study of all of those nonverbals. Architecture, the arts, music, movement, facial expression, costume, vestments, all of that has pedagogical implications. It's not just something nice to do if you have the time or if you're aesthetically inclined or whatever have you. It is an essential part of our preaching ministry. The word is acted, you see. What do we say? Action speaks louder than words, and I think it does. The blow with the back of the hand, or the embrace, or the touch, or the back rub in the sauna, or whatever have you. Those are actions that speak louder than words. I don't know what your opinion is about a fellow like Martin Luther King, but I think nobody can doubt that here was a sincere Christian person who, so to speak, put his money where his mouth was. I mean, they sicked the dogs on him, and they threw him in jail, and he continued to preach love, and he continued to love, and his body there in jail, or at the mercy of the police dogs or whatever, you know, that was a powerful sermon. And, of course, Jesus is the most powerful sermon of all. Have a person who not just preaches and teaches about love, but who loves even to the cross. Which brings us, dear friends, to sacramental enacting. I mean, that's why the sacraments are important, among other things. Even you can give other good arguments for the sacraments, but the argument that I'm raising right now is one out of action. The word comes to us in written form, that's true, and it's great. It comes to us in spoken form, that's true, and it's great. But it comes to us also in acted form, and that's great. And it's enacted not just ritually, let us hope, on Sunday morning, but also then through the lives of believers all through the week. And I even heard a theologian say maybe the time has come for believers, even on the job in their evangelism, to shut up and to say, watch me. Don't just listen to my words, but watch what I do. That, again, is a terrific responsibility.
That's my reaction when someone comes to the doorbell.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. You know, I am no longer
Jehovah's Witnesses
who thinks and who feels, but I'm so in that they're talking at, because once in a while, when I take the time to respond or really hope to get into a discussion, I'm just not recognized at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, yeah,
see,
sure.
You're talking about the enactment and so forth. This goes back just a little bit. Do you see the movement, for example, like what's this great architect and wrote the book?
Sobic?
Sobic.
You should know his book. Incredible. Ed Sobic. Do they have it over here? Maybe they do. Architecture.
I don't think so.
Architecture for Worship.
Yeah,
that's the book you're talking
for
about.
Worship.
Beautiful.
You know, he primarily now seems to opt at least for a non-cultic kind of building.
Right.
You know, coming into the
multiple use. Yeah.
Building, that kind of thing. Do you see that as being kind of an enactment or a non-verbal communication that's basically good because it communicates something, or that it makes it too secular in the minds of many people?
I hardly think we can be too secular. In other words, I do affirm and agree what Sobic says. I have a little problem with his description of the malady that is... I've heard him speak about this, and I've read his book, and he seems to imply that our fathers and our grandfathers and grandmothers and so on were not really faithful, and that now after, 1,700 years, we're finally faithful again. I don't like that implication. They were faithful in their own way, and we shouldn't be too critical of them. I do have some problems with Gothic architecture the way he does, and I think we should start building buildings that are flexible. If only so that we don't tie our own hands. The future is so uncertain, and we're living in such a yeasty time that anyone who builds a church building, for instance, with the pews all nailed down, is really just crippling himself. liturgically speaking. Not to mention the witness in the community, which is part of Sobeck's point. What does it mean that we have buildings that stand idle for 6 days out of the week and then are used for 1 hour on Sunday morning and then locked up again? Boy, there's something unethical about that in this day and age. And so he's saying, let's use the same space for worship on Sunday and for a potluck dinner on Wednesday and for basketball on Thursday and for... Now, there are limits, needless to say. But... But there's something to be said for the church building being part of the, you know, put at the use of the community. And that's,
see, that's a tough one for most of us.
It sure is.
Just right. Like when we dedicate a church building, which is really cast in the temple.
Yeah, right.
Strictly Old Testament, temple language, that this is the house of God.
Yeah. My argument in here, and we'll get to it later in the week, is that the temple and the tent are two good architectural images. And there's a time for a temple, I wouldn't deny that. And we've got some great temples now, let's face it. But there's a time for tent. And the tent has four qualities that the temple lacks, quoting myself. Flexibility, simplicity, functionality, and expendability. You know, the tent, you take it with you and you pitch it, and you take it down and you take it with you and you pitch it again. And it's simple, it's functional, it's expendable and expandable. You know, we need to be building buildings that have more of the character of tents and less of the character of temples. As a matter of fact, what's that? Beautiful idea. You're picking up on that conversation the other day or so. Yeah. I'd definitely be in favor of that.
How practical would that be?
Well, I'm not thinking of actually a tent with canvas. I mean, I'm not thinking of that.
No, I know that.
But at Syracuse University, here's one model, for example. We have I've been there 15 years now, and we have the temptation 10 years ago. The temptation still nagging with us to build our own Lutheran Student Center. You know, all the Midwest schools have these Lutheran Student Centers. But we have a very unusual situation at Syracuse where the university, although it's just a big secular degree factory these days, it used to have a connection with the Methodist Church. So there's a big building in the middle of campus called the Chapel, Jeffersonian-style classical architecture. Very handsome building, really. All the pews nailed down, unfortunately. And it's the largest auditorium on campus, so you get Timothy Leary to speak there and Bobby Kennedy and these kind of people have spoken. Yeah. Well, these kinds of people have spoken in Hendricks Chapel. And since the beginning, I have been invited to have an office there and to use university space, including for our worship on Sunday morning. And I do that. And we have for 15 years, and it's a hassle. You got to store away the hymn books, and on Sunday morning, pull out all the hymn books, and you got to arrange the chairs. There's several different rooms, needless to say, in this building. And besides the big sanctuary, there's another space that we use for our smaller worship on Sunday morning. But it's a hassle. It's like a mission congregation using the fire hall or the bowling alley or whatever have you. But let me tell you, you mission congregations, you don't know how good you got it. In most instances, you don't have the pews nailed down. You can experiment with space. You can project visuals, or you should be able to.
You can't.
Find another space. Are you a mission? Well, are you using borrowed space?
No, we got our own, but we're in a matchbox. Yeah.
See, what's the first thing missions?
A mile away, and then another mile away, there's
another matchbox.
There's a temple. All of the Lutheran church.
But it seems to me, just from the standpoint of worship, not even from the standpoint of ethics and serving the community, but just from the standpoint of worship, it would be a big mistake these days to build anything that's nailed down or permanent or temple-like. It ought to be tent-like. It ought to be flexible. We ought to be able to move it around. In our situation at Syracuse, there have been years, well, most years, when we have a different architectural setting for every season. We have a different liturgical setting, too, for every season. When I say season, I mean Advent, Lent, Easter, Pentecost, that kind of thing.
I was just going to say, it really takes education to get people in the mission, and then say, we just got to have pews.
Right, that's the symbol of a church. Yeah, it's not really a church until we have pews.
Doesn't that represent permanence?
Sure, exactly. See, the folding chairs, you see, are too temporary. And then one of these days we're going to get pews, and that'll mean that we're really settled.
We're
really a church, yeah. But that's a mistake, don't you think?
Why?
Yeah.
Well,
didn't you say yesterday that, you know, that what young, last night we were talking, young people are struggling for, in a sense, security, permanent things such as this?
Well, I think we seek our permanence in the wrong thing, because the idea is that when we acquire us, then we think, well, permanence is going to be a first unit.
Yeah.
So we get a first unit, then permanence is when we get a sanctuary. So, and then where do we look for permanence beyond that? And then the fact of the matter is, and I want to affirm what you're saying, is that we've got congregations that have gone from mission to death in 20 years because of the mobility of our American community life. And we better be prepared to think in terms of expendable buildings.
Yeah. Well, or using other space, using space that's already available. You see,
but that's expendable in another way.
Right, right. That's why I'm using Syracuse as a model. Here for 15 years, we have not had our own building. We have depended on the generosity of the university, which is still offered to us. It's been a hassle in the sense that we got to rearrange the chairs and bring out the books every Sunday. But I also think we've been teaching several generations of students now that you can have church without pews. You can have, and furthermore, it can be great and exciting and relevant and lively. And you know, in other words, there's something great about that that we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't downgrade.
With my husband and I, have been reading Schubert's books.
Mm. Yeah. Lyle.
No.
Oh.
Robert Schubert.
Oh.
And Garden Grove. Drive-in,
walk. Oh, okay. Yeah. Right. This figures on television. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then you must have real argument between you.
Probably. I'm not quite sure of the burden of what he would stand for, but.
Well, his idea is still vague, and there was the parking space because.
Yeah. I think it's the population explosion being what it is. Let me just say this as an outrageous generalization, which I will immediately qualify. But let me make this outrageous generalization. Anybody who builds a garage these days had better have a pretty good reason for it. We should not build anything unless we have the unequivocal endorsement of every other church or every other family in the neighborhood. Again, that's an outrageous generalization, but we got too many buildings in most instances.
Well, you're not saying don't build big either. You're saying, as my understanding is, that make it multi-purpose,
I'm first of all saying don't build.
So many people.
I'm saying a new church who organizes itself ought to ask, first of all, this question: is there really any reason why I have to build at all? And that's what Sophie says too. I mean, that is his most basic argument, really. Does anybody need another church building in America? Does anybody need another supermarket in America or another parking lot in America? Lord, have mercy on us. I mean, it's basically an ethical question. Do we really need another service station or another house even or another church building?
Are
there other ways of solving the problem than by building another building or pouring more concrete? That's an ethical question.
Are there other facilities, for example, available in your congregation where you're at if the university did not provide it?
Yes, there are, as a matter of fact.
Your congregation would go to it.
Right, right. But it requires a little imagination, you know, to seek it out, and I don't think we've even asked that question up until now.
Yeah, because it really almost be. The question we ask in the American culture is more, is it financially viable?
Yeah.
And if we can afford it, we'll do it.
Yeah, yeah, but we shouldn't ask that any longer.
That's the danger.
Yeah, and I think the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit has been a sign of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought all along, I'm 44 years old now, and all through my life I've been thinking, golly, bigger and faster and better, and, you know, that's the sign of progress, and that's America, and that's the kingdom of God. But now we're beginning to discover, my goodness, you kill fewer people at 55 than at 65. Now that ought to teach us something.
Out here at 70.
Now it isn't.
It was.
Well, yeah.
Yes.
But
I mean, in other words, is bigger always better?
No.
Is faster always better?
But is slower always better?
No, again, there's certainly optimums here.
We'll talk to you after. We have a real talk.
Do that, all right.
But our ALC church in North finally came out with at their convention that they were going to have a study when a new church, whatever it's been organized, and build a new building.
Yeah.
But it's restricted now to a certain number in an area. Which
well,
is great because you've got ALC, LPA, Missouri, Wisconsin, whatever, some of them within 2 or 3 blocks of one another.
We had a first unit mission out in the suburbs of Syracuse, and a couple of years ago they got a new pastor, and right away he was hot to build their final sanctuary, you know. And I pleaded with the guy, I said, oh, gee, don't build. And if you build, ask us all if it's okay. you know, ask all the other congregations if they agree that you need a building out there. And my feeling is we should have a sense of diocese. And we should not, no congregation should be making unilateral decisions about building. About building. Maybe it should not be making unilateral decisions about a lot of other things, too.
I see that opens that whole idol of autonomy, too.
Yeah, it sure does. How autonomous are we? I don't think we're as autonomous.
I think what she's referring to is not much the building, but the fact that the tenants now get together and determine.
Yeah.
Is AFU in here, or all going in here? Or,
right.
In other words, they'll pick the one that has the most possibilities.
Very good. We should have been doing that long ago, don't you agree? Here's a comment.
I was going to say the format you're setting there for determining whether it's built or isn't built, almost ensures that you don't build.
That wouldn't be so bad. Do you really think? I mean, maybe.
Well, our congregation is such that they built a small sanctuary a number of years ago, and 12 years ago, and the congregation has grown considerably since then, and I suspect you're probably all for this, but we have 3 services and try 4, you know, and the cat is on his last breath on Sunday. And many people are sitting out in the narthex during services, and so you really aren't encouraging people to join us in worship.
I'm willing to admit.
And we've gone through a year and a half of planning, and we're almost getting to the point now where we're talking about adding on for another 150 pews.
Yeah.
But if we'd have to go through the other congregations in our district and see what they thought about it, we'd be 10 years away from it yet.
Well, try it. See what happens. Maybe not. You see, maybe, as a matter of fact, this guy, the pastor that I'm referring to in our suburb, he was a very open fellow, and although he really did want to build, he did come to the other churches and say, what do you think? And the other churches agreed, well, we think you should build. So, it may not be so tough as you think. And I admit it, it's an outrageous statement and it's an overgeneralization. But I still think it ought to start us thinking, is building a bigger building America's answer?
Mm-hmm. How do you think that's working out in Columbia, Maryland, where they're using the one building for Jewish?
I haven't heard a thing.
I've heard it wasn't working out so well.
Well,
you
it's
got
not
problems.
Working out in what respect? Financially, it's not working.
I really haven't heard any detail.
The danger with Columbia is that nobody owns it.
Nobody takes
you're
care.
You're only renting it, and your rent is going up because that's the agreement, and you're not amortizing the loan. That's a whole thing. Yeah. Secondly, Columbia was built after a model where the suggestion was that we're going to be innovative, and whether you like it or not, we're going to be innovative. And so half of the people who are in Columbia are innovative, and they don't want that kind of a thing, and so they're going to the more traditional churches of whatever denomination round about.
That's
so that the congregations in Columbia are not serving Columbia to the extent that they perhaps could with a more flexible kind of a program. I think those are the two.
You got to ask those questions. Yeah.
The idea of the people gathering though on Sunday morning, packed with Lutheran, Methodist, UCC, it's just great.
Yes.
I mean, they gather after church and they're not common nothing.
Yeah. This is what we do at Syracuse, as a matter of fact. This big Jeffersonian building that I told you about is used constantly through the week and on Sundays too. There must be 4 or 5 congregations in there on Sunday, including our Lutheran, big ecumenical service, Roman Catholic at Mass at 1 o'clock. I mean, the building really gets terrific use, and I think it's well cared for. And for our part as Lutherans, we give a little gift every year to Hendricks Chapel to say thank you. And we don't have to worry about the plumbing or the roof leaking. The university does.
What about the altars? Do you have to reverse that? Or?
Well, again, there are several different spaces in this big building. And there's a big university, the place where Bobby Kennedy made his speech. I mean, that seats 1,200, and it's got all the pews anchored down, and it's got a platform, and it's got an altar, and it's got a console, a fabulous organ, Holtkamp organ, great choir on Sunday morning, 60-voice student choir, they're excellent. And I've used that space, and I've been in charge more and more now of that ecumenical worship. But when you've got that kind of a setting, you're really stuck. We're all the chaplains, there, four or five of us, are talking about the day when we can remodel that interior space and make it more flexible on the lines of Sobeck's book. But the space that we use is downstairs, first floor, and it's a lounge. It's during the week, it's a coffee lounge. And we put up chairs, and we have a white table, and we can put the table anywhere we want to, and we can put the chairs in any direction we want to. We can darken the place and project. We can dance. We can, I mean, it's very flexible. But you got to store it all the way. What's that?
To me, that would just be a carryover. That's just something you have to do with.
Yeah, right. You put up with it. And I think it's worth putting up with. I mean, that's been the whole point.
I would do it forever.
You'd do it forever?
No, I wouldn't.
You wouldn't?
I would.
You'd want a permanent space.
No, because I have to have a worshipful.
This is worshipful. I guarantee you it's worshipful.
No, well, maybe
banners, the place.
I keep that forever.
Yeah, well, I want them. If
well,
I can get away with it.
That's what our church building does. I mean, you know, on Sundays we're not there in the service. The mother-daughter dinner's there. They just sort of close off the altar area and everything else. I think, we're so hooked into that worship is when you sit down on Sunday morning. And something that impressed me, too, about going to...
Well, we're hooked into the temple image. You see, we've been sold for 200 years on that temple image.
Right, yeah.
The temple is stained glass, fixed pews, an altar way up there in the misty distance. Well, sure. Yeah, sure it does. But, I mean, if you are given a rectangular space and chairs and a table, what would you do with it? Most Americans, most Christians, I think, of the last 200 years would put the table smack against that short wall.
No,
in the old days, this is exactly what they would have done. They'd arrange the chairs in pews, in lines that looked like pews, everybody facing in one direction. Every Sunday, mission churches do it. That's what a church looks like. Well, all right. Now, they've learned something, you see, in 10 or 15 years. They've learned. Right. And they learned that model, you see, is just one of at least four.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's
four.
The only thing they thought of in those years as a carryover. But now the altar is brought down close to the people.
Very good.
With the
chairs around.
Nail down pews.
No, they're not nailed down the street. You can hang off
your wife. It's really tough to do those things. We were in a mission congregation in Virginia, and the pastor there went one Sunday to put the altar right at the main entrance and make people walk around the altar and sit down. We moved things around routinely, but he never had the guts to do that because he feared the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a real difficult thing to be willing to make changes and to face the reactions of the people. You know, how much flack are you willing to take? For example, we were in a military situation. About 40% of our people were military, and that guy never preached about the war.
Yeah,
never. He just laid off that topic altogether. Well, I guess he tried it once and. These are things that not just pastors but church councils are kind of leery of getting into. We've got all kinds of ideas for our
chiefly
sanctuary now, but boy, do we get flagged every time somebody.
This brings up another. In fact, it brings up two more points. One is. People say, I like, I know what I like. They really should say, I like what I know. In other words, it's what we are familiar with that we have come to like. And I really think it's a matter of familiarity. If the people in your congregation begin to go to other churches or travel around the country and see how it's done in other churches, as people are these days, or if you can get them once to worship in the parish hall, for instance, instead of in the church, or worship in a place where, you know, even a conference or a retreat center around the campfire, you know, down at the lake, that kind of thing. Then people begin to say, well, gee, there are other possibilities than the one I grew up with. We always like the one we grew up with. You know, that's human nature, to like what you are familiar with. However, that teaches, does it not, that we just have to get familiar with other possibilities and maybe we'll like them.
But that we shouldn't make a change just merely for change.
Just for the sake of change, right? I made that clear yesterday.
Now, there's a lot of things churches are trying, and they think just to be different.
Right.
But they don't add one iota to the work.
Yeah, there's not much sense in that at all, is there?
No.
That's kind of ridiculous. Furthermore, and this brings up to my second point, whatever we do has a what I would call a context, even an apologetic context, in the sense that what I am doing for my people, I think those people need. And it may be quite different from what you think your people need, or from what they needed 100 years ago, or what they may need 50 years from now. One of my perceptions is that the churches are kind of cold and stiff, and they need a little more informality and a little more warmth and so on. A little more spontaneity, maybe even. A little more excitement. Okay, so I'm working for that in middle-class, fairly rigid Lutheran congregations. Now, I have to realize that St. Paul, when he writes his letter to the Corinthians, is in a different situation altogether. And the worship there is apparently so freaky and so spontaneous, you know, that they're getting drunk and they're eating the communion meal before the poor get there and so on. And so he has to say, look, a little more order, please. you know what I mean? It's a contextual thing, in other words. And in one context, you say one thing, and in another context, you may say quite the opposite thing. But both are true. And I think we have to ask ourselves, what do our people need to break them out of their shells or to bring them the gospel more vividly and more relevantly? And let's not kid ourselves that that's the final answer and that everybody's got to do it our way. This fellow.
Well, I wonder if part of our problem, too, is that we don't really, we're so impatient, and I'm thinking now as Americans, that we kind of want everything to be done in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And we don't, how often in the parishes where we live, do we ever have a session like this, where we really talk about worship and the meaning of worship, or what we're trying to do in worship? And it just doesn't happen. Then we wonder why people don't want to change, because
they don't understand.
Worship is a
cut and dry thing,
there's no rationality to it.
We never did get to the Red Books, did we?
On the other hand, too, maybe they do understand. But maybe they've felt these things out themselves and they realize they don't want to change them.
Right, that's a possibility.
Because of the fact that you don't change them,
you
don't understand.
What do you do about
it? And just because a thing is old doesn't mean it's bad.
No.
And just because a thing is new doesn't mean it's good.
What do you do about noisy chairs?
Noisy chairs. Big problem. There are unnoisy chairs, too. We're going to have to quit, aren't we, friends?
Okay, that I'd like to hear about.
We'll talk about that next time.